Hello, and welcome to Viewpoints, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. On this week's show, we'll be talking about birding by ear, and we'll be speaking with a blind ornithologist.
But first, to our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Dave Engebretson, the aforementioned blind amateur ornithologist.
My mother didn't let me go to any kind of special school. She had this old saying, was, if something came up that I said I couldn't do, I said I can't do that, she'd say, can't, never did nothing.
Now, there's interesting advice. And, you know, we hear that advice from so many of the people we interview who have been successful and done interesting things, that really the bottom line is there's no reason for not being able to do something. You find a way of doing it, you find an alternate way, and somehow you work things out. And sometimes just with a little bit of encouragement, that's all it takes, and to know something's possible.
We'll be actually meeting Dave in a little while, but you'll certainly get the impression that he has a very, very thorough can-do attitude about lots of different things.
Well, that's for sure. And he does lots of other interesting things besides ornithology. And actually, we decided to do another show later in the year on his other specialty, which you'll hear about soon.
Turning now to our low-tech item, we'll meet Dave Engebretson.
My name is Dave Engebretson. I teach at Western Washington University in the Department of Geology. I've been married almost 45 years, proud of that. I got my degree first one at Western Washington State College, which is now the university, and then came back here after a PhD at Stanford University in geophysics. We love boating and hiking and all kinds of things to do up here in the Northwest.
We're going to focus on birding by ear in this particular show, but as Dave mentioned, he also has some other interests. He's a professor of geology, and we had a very interesting discussion about that, but that was too much information for this show, so you'll be hearing more about that later in the year and how he manages to do some unique data interpretation using audio sounds.
I gather you're blind, right?
About 95%, yeah. I can still get some light out of things, and some, if there's lots of contrast, as long as the sun or any light's not right in my eyes, I can see a little bit.
And what's the nature of your visual impairment, the cause?
It's called cone rod dystrophy. It's where the cones and rods are deteriorating, and I'm not sure of the cause. And it's kind of works from the inside out, central vision out, so I don't have any real central vision anymore.
Have you been blind since birth then?
I've been legally blind since birth, and legally blind just means 20/200, I think, or a significant loss in field of vision, which I've suffered from both. But I didn't really start getting down to where I am now until about 15 years ago or so. Before then, with my glasses, I had about 20/200 vision, something like that.
So I think it's interesting how he distinguishes between being legally blind and where he is now, which is something that Pete and I have pretty much been referring to as functionally blind. Because when you were a kid, Pete, you had 20-something vision. It was a little bit usable.
Yeah, I had less than 20/200 vision, maybe 20/400 vision. And, you know, I didn't really consider myself blind, although legally that's the definition of being blind. I probably should have used a cane for crossing streets, but I didn't. And mostly it meant for me that I just looked very closely at things. And since I was young back then, I didn't drive a car, that wasn't an issue. And it really wasn't such a big deal, but, you know, I didn't notice the difference.
Dave has a lot of interests. Today we'll be talking about birding, and another show, as we mentioned, we'll be talking about geology. One of his other hobbies actually interfered with him trying to learn Braille.
Do you use Braille in audiobooks?
You know, I use audiobooks now. I have started last year or so. I've never learned Braille. I play a lot of guitar, and I can't feel very well with my... Well, I play bass guitar, so my right hand's kind of calloused up, and my left hand is too. That's my excuse. I really should try to learn it, but, you know, I'm doing just fine without learning it so far.
Well, you know, that's kind of funny. We got a bass because Pete plays piano, and he always wanted someone to play the bass, but this instrument moved into the house, and of course he had to try to play it, and he got so many calluses he couldn't read Braille, so he gave up the bass.
I was going to ask you, was it stand-up bass or electric bass?
This was a stand-up bass.
No wonder.
Right.
Yeah, well, should get yourself an electric bass.
That bass created some pretty big calluses. I used to joke with people that I was the first person to become blind from playing the bass because I couldn't read the Braille. But I guess it also inhibited other people from learning Braille.
But your priority was Braille and his priority was the bass.
Right. And I just had to find another bass player for our jazz trio.
We first met Dave through his son.
That was interesting. Yeah, I used to interact with a lot of people from Freedom Scientific, and his son, Dave Jr., used to work for Freedom Scientific, and I believe that's where I met him. And that's how this birding show came about. I remember that when Dave was in college...
Dave Jr., yes.
He put together some kind of device for helping the blind deal with birding issues and listening to different birds. And so I contacted him years later. I hadn't heard from him in a while. And he said, well, you really ought to speak to my dad. He's a real expert. So that's what put us in touch with Dave Sr., who we're interviewing today.
And it turns out that they both went blind at about the same time on the calendar, not the same age.
I think he had it harder than me because he had good vision. I never knew what it was like to have good vision, so in that sense I was always making up for, you know, not having the vision all my life. I think it was easier for me to slide into almost total blindness than it would have been for him. I'm not saying it's easy.
Yeah, I always tell people, you know, in some sense I feel kind of lucky that I kind of slowly lost my vision. It gave you a chance to adjust. You know, I was used to it. For me, that's what's common. Whereas yeah. When you're all of a sudden 60 or 50 and lose your vision suddenly and you're used to driving and doing all sorts of things with your eyeballs, that's a tough transition.
That's exactly what I was trying to say, yeah. And it was tough for him. And I didn't give him a lot of, I guess I was sort of to him like my mom was to me. You know, just tell him, kind of just work through it, see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, easier to say than do, but, you know.
Well, there's that can-do attitude again that is really very helpful in encouraging people to do what they need to do.
You are listening to Viewpoints.
This week's focus topic is birding by ear for the visually impaired. Dave's been birding for years. He first got introduced to it from a friend who was interested in birding and suggested they go out together.
I had a good friend that was actually on my thesis committee in grad school. He had some hearing issues, and of course I have the seeing issues, and he would always keep telling me what bird he's seeing. And he started teaching me how to identify him, or I started getting interested in it. He's fun to be with anyway. We still go walking a lot. He just turned 80, so he's still doing it. His sight is getting worse now too, but so it all came from a friend of doing geology together essentially, and then, you know, everywhere you go there are birds. So that's how it got started about 15 or 18, maybe 20 years ago now.
That's a great combination. So he was doing the visuals and you were doing the auditory.
That helped so much. That's what I would suggest if anybody wants to get into it that is visually impaired, to find a friend that can put the binoculars on the birds. And that's one way to learn quite quickly. Well, I shouldn't say that. I have to relearn every year, like when the transients come in, you know, the warblers and the flycatchers and things like that. It's a tough thing to do. Everything sounds the same when you first start.
One thing I always thought was interesting, Nancy and I take lots of walks through the woods. And of course, I can hear all the birds, as can she. And I just assume that she can see them all. And I'll say, what kind of bird is that up there? And she'll say, I don't see anything.
You know, that's funny you mentioned that because my wife, Debbie, she's gotten pretty good at the hearing, but she's had the same trouble. You have to really get into the sighting a bird. You know, they're so small, and they like to hide, especially the ones up in the trees that hide pretty well, like the warblers.
So I would guess even sighted folks need to train their ears somewhat, because you don't always get a good look at these birds. Is that correct?
You'll get more birds if you can hear them than not, and often I can get more birds than a sighted person that doesn't know the sounds. So it helps to know both. Some birders are so good at both that they, you know, they get them all.
I guess it's not necessarily a disadvantage being visually impaired if you're birding, and it looks like it's a sport that can appeal to young people, old people, and just about anybody.
And it's a great excuse to go hang out outside.
Oh, yeah, it's great. Good exercise and good company, and hopefully you have some nice days doing it.
So Dave mentioned that he has to relearn many of the birds every year. Here are some tips that he gave for getting started.
They come and they go. You know, the transients, when they come in, they take over the locals, and start in the winter and when there's fewer birds and get the locals work out. That's what I would do.
Well, I thought that was interesting. We scheduled this show to air in May because we thought, well, that's when people start birding. But that's not what he indicated, huh?
Well, I think that's an exciting time of the year for people who are already birders, because that is when the main migration starts. And but it turns out if you're a beginning birder, it's a good idea to start practicing in the winter when there aren't so many birds around. So we apologize if we messed up the timing, but what the heck, birds are wonderful any time of the year.
And you can keep these tips in mind for next year.
Dave had some other pointers for beginners.
Another mistake that people make, or that I made, I'm not saying everyone would make this mistake, but that would be trying to listen to a CD that has, say, all the Western North America birds or Eastern North America birds. It just totally saturates the audible part of your brain, and it's not a good way to do it, I don't think. So another suggestion would be get a CD that has the birds and, you know, use some sort of technique to make your own CD or USB thing to just play a few birds. Listen to them at dinner. Listen to them in the car. Have them say the names, you know, because usually on these CDs they'll give you the name and then there's the bird. So do that at first is what I would do. But really pare it down to just a few, like 10 or 20 of the most common birds around you. And then when the warblers and the flycatchers and the vireos and all that start coming in, then you've got a chance. It's so fun. I got to tell you that, though. It's an amazing thing I'd have to also warn everybody that if they're really going to start to do it, count on not being able to not do it or whatever. I don't know the right words there, but
once you get started, it's hard to stop.
I can't not do it. I hear them all the time, no matter what I'm doing. So,
huh?
Yeah.
In our conversations, Dave mentioned that when you're buying these CDs, you can Google for bird CDs and get many hits on the web and find many resources. It turns out that some of these CDs are localized. So you may get a CD of the Northeast or the Southwest, and you ought to get the particular CD for your area to focus in on the birds that you're most likely to hear in your area.
One thing that really struck me was Dave's comment that once you get started birding, it's impossible to stop. And of course, one of the reasons we interview people on this show is because we want to cover topics that we're not knowledgeable about. Neither Pete nor I is a birder. And I like going outside and hearing the birds, but I never really paid attention to which was which. Well, sure enough, after interviewing Dave and researching the topic and listening to different kinds of bird songs and learning a little bit about it, man, I go outside now and all of a sudden it's like, wow, this one's different, this one's different, this one's different, and I'm just mesmerized by these bird songs. And all I did was have a conversation with Dave and spend a few minutes on the web.
Yeah, they were just all birds to me before, just some nice sounds, and they were good background as we were hiking through the woods, but I'm really pretty interested now in learning what some of these specific birds are so I can identify them by sound.
So thanks to Dave for more than just the interview, and we hope he gets more people hooked on listening to birds too. So he talked about getting birds. Now, hunters mean one thing by that, but birders mean that they've just got confirmation that they identified a particular bird. And it's very common among birders to keep a log of what birds they've seen. So I gather a lot of sighted people bring notebooks or books with lists of birds in them so they can check off the ones they've seen. What do you do for keeping track of your new birds?
If I go out and do a bird survey, I'm usually with somebody that's taking the notes. I think about the last 10 or 12 years, we do what's called a birding census. It happens in June all over the country. You've probably heard of those, where it's an incredible day. I never get as tired as I do on those days. So the person I'm with, which is usually Clark Blake, we have a list that we go by, and he keeps track. Or when Debbie and I do a bird survey, she keeps track.
So that's a great way of doing things, and that works for Dave. Other people might think of other ways of doing that. There are plenty of portable recorders like the Bookport or handheld little things, and you could just record the name of the bird you've heard along with possibly the sound of the bird, and these things will fit in your pocket. And I'm sure other people have developed their own methods of recording birds. But this sounds like a nice friendly way of doing it. Just take a companion and have them write it down.
Right. And Dave often goes birding with groups.
Well, you know, it does two things. It might scare some away, but I've been told that birds like to see what might be challenging them. They actually start doing some of their alarm calls. And birds do calls and they do songs usually. So you can get birds by actually disturbing them a little bit, or, you know, they try to figure out, sometimes even come out to see why they might be in danger. So it does both things. It can scare them away for sure, but also they often do an alarm call that you can kind of get a lot of species just by their alarm.
Yeah, that was news to me. I figured if you were too noisy going through the woods, you'd scare them all away. But I guess you can actually get more information by hearing both the alarm sound and their song sounds.
And if it turns out that going out in the woods trying to attract birds with a bunch of people isn't a problem, well, Dave sometimes brings his guide dog, Fritz, also. You said sometimes you bring Fritz out birding with you. What kind of effect does he have on the birds?
I always bring Fritz with me. He goes everywhere. I think I've only left him alone like 3 times in 10 years. So he is very, very patient. Lately, he just lays down because he's getting more and more tired. He doesn't like to stand a lot. But if I'm with my birding friend, Clark, he walks really slow. So Fritz slows down and he does the pace. If I'm walking with Debbie, walk a little faster and he'll do that too. And then we'll stop and he'll be very quiet. Wait till we're done and then he guides me to the next spot.
Do the birds, like, stop making noise or make extra noise or what when he's... you wouldn't know because he's always there with you, I guess.
Well, no, but you can tell because I think you can tell that the alarm calls are still there. And Clark has never mentioned that there's any difference.
People really bind with their guide dogs, and it's nice to know that you can do just about everything with them. As Dave mentioned, his guide dog is getting old and tired, and he expects to have it maybe about one more year. And I asked him what he'd be doing with the dog after that. Well, apparently, it will become his wife's dog, his wife, Debbie. And so I guess they'll keep the dog around and remain one big happy family. That's nice.
It'll be interesting to see how Fritz reacts to having some other dog come along and try to take over his role.
Do you have any favorite birds that you like to listen to?
My favorite sound comes from the thrushes. Swainson's thrush is just a wonderful sound. It also means summer around here. And they're all over the country, so you probably get them too. A lot of the thrushes have what they call ethereal sounds. They're quite wonderful to listen to. There's hermit thrush and Swainson's thrush.
Do you imitate any of these?
That's really hard. The Swainson's thrush is kind of like a ascending, almost more like a warbler than a warbler is.
Now, how well did he do imitating that bird?
Well, he said it was hard, but let's see how well he really did.
Not bad. I like that.
There's so many different birds, and every one of them makes a different kind of song and sound. And how are you going to actually learn all of these different birds and keep them straight in your head? Well, Dave, of course, has some hints and tricks for doing that.
It's a very hard thing to learn, I think. It was for me, because they do sound so much the same until you really start zeroing in on them. Then by the time that you're just starting to get them, then they leave again. I've mentioned warblers a few times. I do have a couple of favorite warblers. One's called the Townsend's Warbler. And you'll get into books and they'll try to tell you what the sound is, you know, and it'll be C-H-I-Z-Q-R-L-L or something. You can't do it with that. You have to actually hear the thing, I think. But the Townsend's Warbler does a William Tell Overture sound. So I call him the William Townsend Overture. If you remember it, the black-throated gray warbler has a real buzzy sound. So I do something like, eat your cheesy pizza.
So you have your mnemonics.
Yeah, you need those. And you can get some off of different CDs, I think, or different recordings of what people have used. The black-capped chickadee, which you might have heard about, it often does a three-parted sound that some people use. Hey, sweetie. It goes, dee-dee-dee. You'll have those probably singing right out, right where you are now. And it's either hey, sweetie, or cheeseburger. Cheeseburger. It drops a minor third.
That's great.
You'd be good at it because, you know, you can go to the piano and do a B-flat down to a G or something like that.
Right. Play out their tunes.
Yeah. So if you hit a B-flat and then two Gs like that, you'll get it, you know, very close.
Pete actually pretty often gets into conversations with the birds when we're out in the woods, but no idea what kind of bird it is. And of course, I'm looking all over and all I'm seeing is trees, and neither one of us knows what the bird is, but they're having a great chat.
Well, that's a great way of remembering the bird sounds, is with these mnemonics.
Well, so you may remember Dave tried to imitate a Townsend's warbler. Here's the real thing. Again, he did pretty well.
Oh, that sounds so bucolic. Ah, excuse me, I have to wake up.
So you can tell Dave's really enthusiastic about birding, and he's clearly been having a great time sharing his enthusiasm with us. Well, we're not the only ones he shares his enthusiasm with.
The people you go out with when you do go in a group are quite fun. Clark and I have given lots of field trips for people that are trying to raise money for the land trust, and so we've taken quite a few people out. Oh, and we've done owl prowls. So you go out, just after dark, and you try to call up some owls.
Now, that's a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I'm very active with our local land trust, and we cooperate extensively with the local birding communities, because what's good for preserving open spaces is also good for the birds, because they reside in the open spaces that we protect. So this is a nice symbiotic arrangement that we have between the two groups.
But the other thing I thought was neat was, it's interesting to learn about the birds and the different sounds and be out in the woods with nature. But, he also indicates it can be a nice social outlet. People do this in groups, and there are birding groups in town. If you look around where you live, you'll find groups who do bird, and there are national groups, of course, and people take trips all over.
So we've been talking a lot about birds. If you go online, you can find all manner of different bird songs and bird calls, and Dave suggested some ways you can have fun with these digital recordings. So here's a wood thrush.
So one of the ways Dave suggested having a little fun with that sound was to take a recording program on your PC, like Audacity, and then you can slow it down and hear what it sounds like in detail.
And here it is at 1/4 of the original speed, but without affecting the pitch.
You can hear there's a lot of detail in there that happens very quickly that your ear may or may not pick up depending on how attuned you are to listening to these sounds.
And for something totally different, here's a common raven.
It sounds like it's laughing at us.
Yeah.
So what can you do in Audacity with that one?
Well, that one we slowed down to 1/4 of its speed, but while we were at it, we allowed the pitch to drop to 1/4, which would be down by 2 octaves.
Now that sounds a lot more threatening, doesn't it?
Sounds like a cross between Frankenstein and a power tool.
But it's fun, so you can play around with that, and there are lots of bird sounds you can do that with. Again, the program we used for that was Audacity, and we'll have a link to where you can download Audacity. It's a free audio editing program. We'll have a link on our website.
We got all of these bird sounds from the Cornell Lab for Ornithology, and we'll have links to the appropriate part of that website where you can get all of these bird sounds. Now for this week's high-tech item, online birding by ear software that you can learn from, including lots and lots of recordings of bird songs and calls. So we already mentioned the Cornell Ornithology Lab, or more familiarly referred to as the Cornell Bird Lab.
It's amazing how many resources are out there. Again, let Google be your friend. We had the Cornell people suggest several places we could go explicitly, but there's lots of results that come up in Google.
The Cornell Bird Lab also runs Celebrate Urban Birds, which is a citizen science project and has lots of tips for birding for the visually impaired, and includes links to books and quizzes and other kinds of activities that you can use to learn from. And There's actually a group in Texas that has an annual birding competition just for visually impaired birders. They call it the Out of Sight Songbirder Tournament, and they have a great YouTube video, and we'll have that link on the show notes on our website as well.
I think they also had some events where they talked about birding by touch for the blind. So they must have some way of having people feel the birds so they can get an idea of how big they are and how many feathers.
I think that's all part of the same event. And then there was something else a little bit different that I found. That's a blog by Nathan Peplow and Andrew Spencer called earbirding.com. And they have an awful lot of something they call a spectrogram or a sonogram or a sonogram, which is a visual representation of the sounds the birds make with the lower frequencies or pitches at the bottom and the higher frequencies or pitches near the top. And if you can see, you can actually see the trace of the sounds that the birds are making, and some of them are really beautiful.
And how about if, like me, you can't see these spectrograms?
Well, now that's the cool part. They use the spectrograms as a vehicle for very meticulously and systematically describing the sounds that the birds make. And I think you don't actually have to see the spectrograms because their descriptions are so good. You know, they'll describe it as either rising or falling, and they describe the tempo, and they describe everything about the bird sound. And if you can see, you're looking at the spectrogram while you're reading this description, but the descriptions are so good that you don't really need the visual of the spectrogram.
I guess I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool. And of course, they have some audio clips to go along with the descriptions.
Okay, we'll have that in the show notes also, so look for it.
If you missed any of the links we've given in this show, they'll all be in the show notes, which you can find at our website, www.viewpointsplus.net. That's it for show 1218, but we can't resist playing one more bird song. This one is a northern cardinal. Next week on Viewpoints, we'll be talking about teaching science to visually impaired youth. Laboratory experiments are an important part of a science education. We'll speak with Marilyn Winograd and Lillian Rankel about techniques and tools they've developed to enable visually impaired students to participate fully. We'll also discuss efforts to spread this around the world, including a book of experiments that children can do at home. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to contact@viewpointsplus.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Viewpoints, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey in partnership with WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.viewpointsplus.net. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Viewpoints Plus. We hope you'll join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Viewpoints, and have a nice day.